Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. There are some artists who speak strongly to their time. Their words and images resonate and then they disappear. These days, outside her hometown of Adelaide, that could just about be said of Barbara Hanrahan. In 1988, Peter Goldsworthy described her as the most original writer in Australia today. 15 of her books were published, and her flamboyant, sometimes shocking prints are still recognisable, even by those who've forgotten her name. Barbara Hanrahan's subject was the lives of women, but ordinary people fascinated her too, and under her gaze became strange and exotic creatures. Here's The Strangeness of the Ordinary, the art and life of Barbara Hanrahan. The producer is Nicole Steinke.
This is our print room, and I've got some of our prints by Barbara Hanrahan out for you to have a look at today.
Thank you.
My God.
Colour, so much colour.
Yeah. We've got about 200 of her prints here in the Art Gallery of South Australia collection, but the ones that I got out to me really show her great leaps and changes of her style and also how distinct she is.
Well, I was a young art school student when Barbara came back from London, and she came in to teach printmaking and gave us a talk. I would have been all of like 17, and she had her hair cut very dramatically with a fringe and a bob and a very pale white face, and she'd come from London, you know, so she had this aura around her and we all just were in awe of Barbara. She came back with a reputation. But also Barbara was you got a sense that she was taking everything in. You know, she was an observer.
I grew up with three women, my mother, my grandmother and my little Mongol great-aunt. And I spent a lot of my time away in London. And I think just being away from Adelaide, being away from Theberton, made me aware of how exotic, how strange these people were, how extraordinary they were through their very ordinariness. It's a funny word to say.
Well, a scent of eucalyptus was very strongly accepted and reviewed, and everybody read it and everybody loved it, as far as I know. The second book, not so. And then a series of books which were greeted really with some puzzlement. Somehow she got too hard for us. Her thinking took her further away from us being the women readers that I knew. I don't know. Everybody always loved her painting, and people collected it and gave it as presents, and it was always much more successful than her novels.
So, thank you very much for lunch. What now?
We'll show you Barbara's picture that she gave me.
So you have a Barbara?
I do. And here it is, Wartime Wedding. She made it in 1983, and I think that's a portrait of Barbara there as the bridesmaid or matron of honour, I'd say. So it's charming and very pretty, and it's also slightly sinister, I think.
And this work here is completely different. This is Mosshead Girl, number one, from 1977. So this is, you know, bright, hot pink, this fantastic, heavily worked surface of the moss-haired girl, and there's a bearded lady at her feet, and actually the moss-haired girl has male genitalia, so it's hard to know what is going on. I mean, I just love this work. I don't know why.
She saw herself as someone, obviously, that was had this mission in life to be a creative person, and she wasn't going to be deflected from that. The issues of feminism, while the 60s was a time of challenge, you know, the actual, you know, female eunuch would have passed her by, like Jackson Pollock would have passed her by. That's not what she was interested in. She was interested in herself as her muse and the way she was responding to the outside world.
Wednesday, 18th of April. I feel dreary and awful when I don't work at something creative. The world seems dull and empty with great spaces everywhere. Raining. Books everywhere and house in a terrible mess I am sick of. Now I will begin to put things away. I've stayed in nightie and dressing gown all day today.
I didn't know Barbara at all well. I met her perhaps three times. I think it was 1983. And between 1976 and 1979, I was the women's advisor to the Premier of South Australia, Don Dunstan, and I was the first women's advisor in South Australia. But in 79, I fell in love with one of my staff members and I became a lesbian hippie, which was perhaps one of the reasons why I was acceptable to Barbara. I don't know, we never talked about me. We only talked about her and the art, and she had her own opinion on me, which I felt was not very high. But nevertheless, it gave me the chance to look at all that art. It was wonderful. Well, my name is Deborah McCulloch, and I've lived in Adelaide most of my life.
So she asked you to open her exhibition?
Yes, she did. I'm pretty sure it was the Bonython Gallery in Jerningham Street in North Adelaide, owned by Kim Bonython, who had promoted all kinds of modern art.
It's wonderful to have another opportunity to view Barbara's work and to celebrate again this very creative life. Every day I'm reminded of Barbara. I have a number of her prints hanging in my house. They've been there for between 15 and 20 years. And not only do I like them as much as I ever did, but I find them just as interesting and absorbing.
We had intense, although not terribly friendly, conversations, two or three of them. We met before the show and she showed me the works that she was going to put on, up for sale, and she asked me to respond to them, and I said, as I remember, that they were the works of women about being a woman, and this self-consciousness was really exciting because it was something that had been denied to women. We have not, until recently, been allowed to reflect upon ourselves, our lives. We've been actively discouraged from doing so. And all these works of art, all of them, were about, to some degree, women, either about Barbara herself or about her mother and her mother's companion, who I think was her sister. And those characters appeared frequently in the paintings, but so did mysterious women and little girls, and there were just women everywhere.
Barbara came from a working class background, but it was a little bit more than that. Her mother worked for one of the department stores, and she was an artist in the advertising department. In those days, the fashions were drawn, they weren't photographed, and I think she probably did that. But Barbara had an unusual upbringing because her father died, and then her mother went to live with her mother in Theberton. I think she was proud of her background, but there were pressures.
Adelaide, it was a small provincial town. It was really no different from Sydney or from Melbourne, except that it was smaller and it didn't have as much money. It had the same stratas of society, but the difference was that in Adelaide, everybody really knew everybody else.
What was your childhood like? Was it as you've written in your books?
Yes, it's the childhood that's recorded in The Scent of Eucalyptus. I grew up at Theberton. My father died when I was a year old, so immediately I went to live with my grandmother, my Mongol great-aunt and my mother, and we grew up, these four women, together. My mother was a commercial artist, so I always thought of her as my beautiful sister. She was someone that would come home at 5 o'clock and smell of bluegrass perfume from an advertising department, whereas my grandmother was with me all the time, a big earth mother figure that worked in the garden and looked after me. And then, of course, Reese was there too, someone to be jealous of, because I always felt my grandmother cared more about her than me.
She was someone, of course, who needed more looking after.
No, she was very bossy. No, I think she probably started off in that way, but no, she had her own role in the household, and she was the one that would order you away from the table when it was time to sweep under the table, and was the one that boiled the handkerchiefs and had her jobs. And she'd always be saying, cease. She was like an Old Testament prophet, really, flourishing her broom and telling you to be quiet.
I'm Maria Zagala, Associate Curator of Prints, Drawings and Photographs at the Art Gallery of South Australia. And the next print is also very early. It's from around 1960 as well, and this is when she's learning how to make prints at the South Australian School of Art, and it's a dry point. And with a dry point, it's her scratching directly into the copper plate with a very sharp instrument, which makes a mark which to me looks very much like a wound. And it seems to me that she, from very early on, recognises the expressive potential of printmaking and then deploys it in this scene, which is about mourning. So it's about the death of a child. And it has this remarkable kind of intensity about it.
She gave me a painting, an etching, for doing the announcement, but she really wasn't very happy with it. Not the etching, what I said. I had said, this is what I'm going to say, and she said, yes, I thought that's what you were going to say. And then I said it, and she said, yes, well, you did say what I thought you would say, as though it was disappointing. And then she went away. This was, you know, while everybody's standing around with their glasses of white wine in those days. Then she came back and said, she implied rather than said, what you don't get, and this is the bit she said, I did it, I do it, I live for art, art with a capital A. And I said, yes, I can see that. Perhaps I should have mentioned it. And then we, as it were, parted. And apart from that, I didn't see her at all in Adelaide until the day of her funeral, when it was either in the paper or on the radio that she was being buried in West Terrace Cemetery. So I was living here, so I got on my bike and got there just as the last people were leaving. And I wish I had known beforehand.
Before you came, I was just looking at the scent of eucalyptus again and think, oh my God, now is that my childhood or her childhood? I almost feel that I've taken on some aspects of her childhood. It just seems so real.
As a child, and ever after, the minute hidden facets of things intrigued me. I was forever walking with my head bent, looking at the ground. I peered into the clipped stems of the valerian and saw greenness. I saw bulbs slit by greener spears. I saw the red geranium turn black and clenched dots turn mauve and into lilacs. I came inside and found the dust that lay under the mat, the stale hair in the brush, the soap's awful underside like a sweaty sore.
The scent of eucalyptus. Oh, God, I love that book.
What is it about the scent of eucalyptus? She's not necessarily a likable character in it. I mean, putting her Down syndrome aunt into the cupboard and torturing her, basically. I mean, she's always willing to reveal the utmost cruelty and lowness in herself.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, most people keep that hidden. So you can read this and think, oh, I might have done that too, but I'm not telling anybody. I love the detail in it. It's a really endearing voice. It feels to me like it's all written with love. It's a real physicality, a tangible physicality, which is beautiful in that writing.
I saw the pleated linings of mushrooms, tomatoes ruffled by stars. carrots hung with tassels. I came closer to the three who were important, to the grandmother, and saw the hair in her nostril, the dirt between her toes, dye spots in her scalp, to the great aunt, and her parting was thick with scurf. She had wax buds in her ear, a sour handkerchief up her sleeve. And my mother tried not to cry. Face all crumpled, eyes gone blurry, ugly mouth square. I watched, unmoved.
When you get to know somebody, it's hard to remember what it was like at the beginning of when you get to know them. But I think Barbara always maintained a level of herself back from people until she got to know people. She reserved a lot. I'm Fidge Miller. I, during the 80s, co-owned with my partner Gail Murphy's Bookshop. Murphy's Sisters was an iconic, innovative, exciting focus for women during the 80s in Adelaide, and I guess was a really powerful part of the growth of the feminist movement. They were heady times, and our Christmas advertisement, we just had Dear Virginia, yes, there are women writers, and then we listed from A to Z.
In my final year at art school and teachers' college, I was surprised and delighted to see Barbara Hanrahan enter the room and announce she was going to teach us principles of teaching too. Strangely, I felt that I had always known her, or at least been aware of her. And whilst I was at art school, I often saw her slipping, gliding silently under the trees along North Terrace, reclusive, head bent forward, absorbed and self-contained, in her hand a portfolio.
And the one next to it, called Conversation with Flowers from 1974, a woman in a garden with these three beaming sunflowers, and this woman is in conversation with another woman, and they're both crying. They've got tears running down their faces. They both have their breasts bared, but they're completely embellished in all of this rich details of flowers, and it's as though they are part of nature completely. This garden is this place of some kind of serenity. It seems to me that it's an image very much about female relationships, so about the sort of maybe honesty or cruelty of female friendship.
Sunday, 1st of January. A weird beginning to the new year. But first, I will tell you all the things we did. Saturday, Joe rested and I tried to work on etchings. I could hear a party going on in house next door as I cut through the stopping out varnish with knife and scissors and got myself dirty, then had to clean fingers and feet and hands up and get ready for Kate Llewellyn's. Got there, house on hump that overlooks the beach, and not bohemian and grotty as I had thought. Kate's sour, sweet little girl voice. Kate is another of the people I could never ask to dinner. Her salad dressing is made of garlic, walnut oil, red wine vinegar. She can't bear bad salad dressing. Whatever would she think of mine?
I'm sitting here, having just eaten a wonderful meal, created by a woman who's famous for her wonderful meals, and Barbara sat in your kitchen in a different house. Mm. Who did you think Barbara was?
She presented to the world a very demure, sweet person. She dressed like a femme fatale from the 40s movies, with a hair draped over one eye, like Victoria.
Veronica Lake,
yes. You know, we never know what people are really thinking, do we? Only our trusted and loving friends we rely on. But I thought that she was a woman with a great passion for printmaking. Some of them are much more startling now than they were in the 70s. They were feminist drawings of genitalia. and babies in womb, or I forget exactly, but I saw one the other day in a friend's house, and I thought, you know, we weren't at all shocked at that when we saw it in the 70s. It was the time, feminism, free sexuality, every second person was a hippie, there was great sexual liberation, great damage to relationships and marriages because people slept around practically for political reasons. Well, wives who didn't want to sleep around were encouraged to by men who wanted to sleep with other men's wives. And sexual organs, that was part of the times, part of the art of the times. And now it's quite confronting and quite disturbing. It's repulsive to look at. It was meant to be shocking, but the times have changed so much that now we're much more shockable.
We all told first memories. Hugh couldn't remember anything. Amanda, blonde, remembered her and girlfriend having showers together, aged 9, touching each other's nipples, kissing like they did in the films. Sex on the gritty Gold Coast beach at 12, because girls mature there early on account of the warm climate. Kate's memory is watching her doll's pram being made. She was Dad's girl, always beautifully dressed. Later. Don't mean to write nastily of Kate Llewellyn, but she's one of the dangerous people who rob me of my own world.
An excerpt from the published diaries of Barbara Hanrahan, unleashed upon an unsuspecting world in 1998, only 7 years after her early death from cancer. Elaine Lindsay edited the diaries. Their publication changed the way Barbara Hanrahan was viewed forever. The whole act of publishing the diaries, it was an interesting decision to make because she says so many negative things about people who thought they were her friends. Publishing them while everyone's still alive.
I'd love to get to Elizabeth Jolly's diaries, but they're all tucked safely away until I think everybody is dead, which is really unfortunate. When I met Barbara in 1978... and I probably didn't see her for some time before she died. Maybe 1989, 1990 was probably the last time I saw her. So I covered a fair span of years, but I never really felt that I knew Barbara at all. And when I did edit the diaries, there was a Barbara there I wish I'd known at the time because there was this whole spiritual side of her, which was of interest to me. And we'd never had that conversation, and I had no idea that she had these spiritual interests. I always felt when I was with Barbara, I was walking a bit on eggshells. I always felt I had to be very careful in case I said something wrong and I might be banished. And I don't know if she did that with people or not, but it was just that feeling. And if I dare say that I didn't like D.H. Lawrence, and I don't really like D.H. Lawrence, that she'd never talk to me again, and that may not have happened at all. But it was just that feeling of being tentative all the time and being careful.
Barbara was a secretive sort of person. She loved mysteries. And you can see that from her books, you know, the secret things and a lot of the, shall we say, anatomical goings on in her prints and in her writing. It's an innocence of a child. And she was interested in these, you know, like people picking their noses and doing things like that. She would talk about it. My name is Jonathan Waugh. I first saw Barbara Hanrahan's work when I was working in the Bonython Gallery in Jerningham Street in North Adelaide in the 1970s. Barbara was a very quiet person when you were with her. Well, for me anyway, she was a quiet and caring person. You felt nurtured in her company.
And what would you talk about?
I've been thinking about this because we didn't talk about art, really, because the friendship was sort of an overall friendship. I think gardens. I know we talked about gardens because I'm a keen gardener, and I know at the Contemporary Art Society I had revamped the garden there, and I can imagine that she would have noticed this because she was a very keen gardener and a good gardener. And, of course, through all her work, her writing and her printmaking and painting, there are flowers. symbolism which goes back to really a sort of Elizabethan times and the early poets. That all comes through her work. So it was a love of nature, and that, of course, came from her grandmother's garden in Theberton.
My grandmother was rooted in her garden, with cheeks ripped by thorns, mud-bruised legs, skirts always caught on a briar. The great aunt reigned in the house. She flapped her arms, and breadcrumbs and the tablecloth cut the air. She hurled knives and the apostle spoons to a silver streak. The mother tended us all, with snail curls and lavender-setting lotions, and a needle flying on over endless wefts and warps.
Have you ever had it suggested to you that a woman is not really whole, not really fulfilled, until she has had a child?
I suppose that would have come when I felt there was a period in my life when I was about 17 and I was pushed into the idea of going to terrible dances in ballerinas with sequins on them and fur fabric capes.
I remember it well.
And I can remember very strongly always being the person that never danced and coming home to the Adelaide railway station, and a dreadful feeling just sort of fell on top of me, and I thought, this is what my life is meant to be, how terrible, I can't do these things.
It was a world of Brill Cream and Brian Ilon and chauvinism of an extraordinary thing. There were only a couple of women working in the newspapers, and, you know, sensitive people invariably have imaginative ideas, which is what I loved about her and what I recognised. And the other thing I loved about her was this wonderful mocking sense of humour, the satirical side of her, of looking at society, the extraordinary eye that she had.
Helen Covington was a journalist with the Adelaide News and Advertiser. The world she knew ran parallel to Barbara's.
In this society, girls wore merry widows and they dressed up, but they were not allowed to do it. The worst thing was to get pregnant. Boys got married at 21 in the working class area. In the city area, men doffed their hats as they walked down the street.
Maybe this is a part of growing up in Adelaide, but I always felt I was given my identity, put in my little tiny box. If I'd stayed in Adelaide, I don't think I would ever have written. But it was just getting away and realising that the rules meant nothing, that, you know, if you wanted to do something, you had to do it. When I was writing Cupid Doll, I made myself read back through lots of the 50s newspapers, and that world was still there with the pictures of the girls on the social notes and the girls that baked the honey frosted dream cake and Miss Soccer Queen and Miss Autumn Leaves Carnival. Things like that. But of course, now that seems rather charming and quaint, but at the time that was the world that you either belonged to, and if you couldn't belong to a world like that, you went off to England. You either got engaged or you went off your trip to England and the continent. So I decided to go to London to an art school.
The so-called elite Adelaide establishment called OAFs, Old Adelaide Families. It was some ridiculous idea that if you had inherited some wealth that you were in fact superior. And when you really look at it, in 1938, when I was born, the colony was almost precisely 100 years old. So how any of them could have had any old Adelaide families? And they devoted themselves to nonsense like Nancy Mitford's book on you and non-you. Well, this was the Bible for the whole of Australia who felt that they were superior. It said, you do not say mirror, you say looking glass. You do not say toilet, you say lavatory. You do not say profile, you say profile. It was just absolutely nonsense, and they judged people by it.
But yeah, Adelaide class conscious. Yes, I suppose it was. We were middle classes, shopkeepers. we'd be aware, when I'd get the steam train to school and we'd go past Mile End and the gas works and we'd all hold our nose and think, oh, well, that's where the poor people are and, you know, smell the gas.
Which
works.
Is very close to where she grew up.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, and I suppose there was a division and you really didn't mix much across that division.
And that's why nearly everybody, like Barbara, hoofed off to London. I went 2 years before Barbara did, in 1961.
Now I sat in a pub in London, tired out after the day's printing, knowing I'd be making more prints the next day because I was a printmaker. And the days of prints stretched out ahead of me, luxurious as a soak in a film star's bubble bath. And I sat there with the boys, feeling alive and young and unplaced. The more prints I made, the more ideas for new ones I had. I prized myself away from all the old things I'd loved and hated. And now, in London, I felt more alive and sensitive than I ever had before.
This life of luxury, blazing on the sunny afternoon. In summertime, in summertime.
In London, Barbara was free to live as an artist. She spent much of the next 20 years there, and at that liberating distance, she began to write about Adelaide from her perspective, that suburban house on the wrong side of the tracks, inhabited by four women. The Scent of Eucalyptus was the first book ever published that put Adelaide centre stage. When it appeared in 1973, it wasn't an Adelaide the Oafs recognised, but many others did. It sold in translation around the world.
Reese is my great aunt. She has frog-like eyes with half-moon lids, sad eyebrows arched in permanent surprise, a domed forehead with wrinkles, a snout and a mouth that shows her tongue, becomes an idiot grin when she is happy. People stare at her in the street. She is real, and reality is too strong for their slumbering, narcotized lives. She is a Mongol. She likes ironing. She unpegs the dry washing, collects it in the wicker basket, sprinkles a benediction over handkerchiefs, tablecloths, bloomers, petticoats, nightdresses, reduces them to the same tight sausage bundles. Her spit sizzles on the iron as she tests its heat. She toils happily, elbows sticking out, red in the face, turning the handkerchiefs into triangles, quartering the tablecloths, folding the bloomers into sexless halves, nosing her iron through petticoat shallows of pin tucks and pleats, guiding it to safe harbour through virginal excesses of nightdress folds.
It's the books of hers that I have read, which, on reflection, I like even better. And the most recent one, I was looking for it before you came, is Chelsea Girl. And I think it's an extraordinarily brave work because it seemed to me what it was about was a working class woman who led a life very much like Barbara Hanrahan's mother, perhaps. She goes into work every day on the tram, wears white gloves, is careful with her clothing. And what was so bold about it was that women as readers, we don't very often like to read of the constraints on our lives. We like to read of women breaking those constraints. Not that I've got anything against it. I'm into it myself. I made my living out of teaching women how to break their constraints. But to write a book about somebody who never tries to, who lives absolutely within those constraints. But, I mean, in fact, she does move against the constraints, but in ways which, compared with the ways in which we discuss it, are so small, like it's what she serves for lunch or the kind of crockery she uses.
Friday, 17th of August. Banal, it says. says she should stick to writing straight fairy tales like the Albatross Muff. Fairy tale indeed. It is so crude and insensitive it makes me feel ill.
She often represents women. In fact, you could say this is her subject. And sometimes it's in a great sense of serenity that they're shown and sensual. And then other times they are figures of great anger. And here it looks like an angry figure. It's printed in red ink. It's blood. It's very hard.
That use of red was significant. It's clear from her diaries that there were many times in Barbara Hanrahan's life when self-doubt and anger engulfed her. Some of the worst times were in London, a place where she tasted success as a printmaker and where her first novels were published by Chatto. And it was while living in London that Barbara encountered Joe Steele, the man who was to be her partner until her death. An inventor and engineer, Joe Steele had also rejected the narrowness of Adelaide society. Elaine Lindsay.
Joe Steele was a very dashing racing car driver. He was a rebel from a good family and he went to St. Boys.
When they met, it was in London, wasn't it?
First time they met, no, that was in Adelaide, but very briefly. And then they went their independent ways and met up again in London. And things took off from there. Well, I mean, I can't say love at first sight because A1 wasn't there and B, it sounds all rather trite. But they just seemed perfect for each other. And Joe was exceedingly caring of Barbara. And Barbara would not have been an easy person to live with because she was quite temperamental. That may be the wrong word, but she definitely, reading the diaries, has ups and downs and dissatisfactions. And I suppose, again, if you're an artist, you're never really satisfied with what you've done, so you're always being frustrated by the stuff that you're investing your life in. But Joe was just fantastic. I can't imagine any other man being so caring, so providing, because they used to stay here at my place every so often, and I'd come home, there'd be fantastic meals. He'd do all the handiwork around the place. He was very observant. He was very caring for other people and nurturing of other people as well. He's just quite an extraordinary man, totally extraordinary.
Be interesting to do a book on Joe. You'd never get it.
Joe Steele is a highly private person. He chose not to be interviewed for this program, although he was welcoming when I visited him in Adelaide. You're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National and The Strangeness of the Ordinary, The Art and Life of Barbara Hanrahan.
When I was a child, living in Theberton, I would always be taken by my grandmother and Rhys, my Mongol great-aunt, up to the hills to visit these aunts. There was Auntie Poll and Auntie Mill and Uncle Jack and Uncle Will. And I mean, I was always frightened of Uncle Jack because he had bristles and you had to kiss the bristles. And I found out, just talking to my mother, that she'd been frightened of him too. And so her story linked up with my story. And Auntie Poll, who was also Auntie Mary, had been the little gentlewoman who I can remember pulling up my socks when I was very small by the agapanthus on our garden path. And I can still remember the sort of thrill of, a sort of lovely sensual thrill that I got when she pulled my sock up. It's just remembering so vividly. And I can see the little whiskery lady that had to be put down in writing. And Auntie Mill was the smart one that always had her hair done in Prevost in Bowman's Arcade. And she had a lovely dress with poppies all over it.
You know, when I look at her novels now, I'm astonished at the scope and at the stories she told and the sympathies and understanding that she had, which were remarkable. She was, on the one hand, really ambiguous about Adelaide. She and Joe had both fled, you know, really angry with the place, angry. And I can imagine that in 71, if you were an artist who liked art with a capital A, it would have been a very hard place to live in. But then they returned and they lived here. But there's not a trace of that anger. She accepts the place in the same way that she accepts the woman. And her knowledge of it is profound.
Adelaide is a very extraordinary place, it seems to me, as someone who lived there for 10 years, but as an outsider myself, in that it's a place of conformity and non-conformity, and more extreme than any other city in Australia, I think. Partly because it's so isolated, it's sort of built on itself, it's so proud of its non-convict past. And the female and the feminist issues within that are almost fighting each other, so that you've got that history in Adelaide of the first votes for women and people like Margaret Preston, the great Adelaide woman artist, you know, Hans Heisen called her that hussy, all making their life within a city that is very controlled socially, but also with this undercutting of fighting against that control. I always think it's sort of like Don Bradman and Don Dunstan. You've got the two sides really clear. And Barbara saw that within the place that she was living, like coming up through her veins.
I had not seen her for a long time when, in 1975, there she was one day, just the same. But in her other hand was the hand of a man. The man was Joe Steele, and they seemed to fit together. And to me, at a distance, they belonged in a novel.
During the years that Barbara was still coming and going between London and Adelaide, did you get a sense that she felt at home in either place?
Yes, I think she did. I think she got a lot from each place. I think Adelaide, she came back on those times to really research for her books. And most of us wouldn't know she was here. They would come in very quietly. Obviously, maybe her mother knew, but they would come in, and when they were ready, you'd get a phone call. Or you'd bump into them and they'd look embarrassed. You'd discovered them. But they just wanted to get on, and I think she wanted to get on without interruption with her research.
I like the time, again in the diaries, when they get a telephone and they unplug it so nobody can ring them. This idea of wanting to be apart from the world.
Sunday, 8th of July. Dinner last night at the Goddards. The level of these people is most depressing. Much sex talk from the men, miniskirts and striptease places, etc. Talk very horrid to Joe and my ears. I tried to hold myself in, but I felt more and more peculiar. David Dolan, a voluptuary, hair in curls like little horns all over his head, fleshy bull face, large nostrils. Oddest part of the evening, when he begins to talk of someone who hates me, at whom he flourishes the postcard I sent him and says, "She's not so bad." And this person said if he wanted a copy of my book, he could have it because it's the worst book she ever read. So bad, she threw it in the rubbish bin. All the time, I think he talks about Barbara Zerbini. But no, it's Shirley Despoja. Fancy that. She hates me so much. I call David Dolan a fat blob. A fat, soft blob, a donkey, said I would like to hit him on the head. He says negative things to me about my prints, never fully extended, decorative, clever craftsman, etc. Also says last book is weak. Well, I have every confidence in peach groves. But what about the one I'm working on now?
In most cases, diaries are held back. Do you think she would have intended her diaries to appear while all the people discussed were still alive?
I think it's a complicated question. Most people who write a diary, I believe, do think that somebody's going to read it. I've kept a daily page-a-day diary for 45 years, and I catch myself writing things for another. You're talking to history.
Joe, with the diaries, I think he was very brave because he was prepared for me to edit the diaries, and he, in fact, didn't know what the content of the diaries was because he hadn't read the diaries. And he came to stay with me to read the typescript after I'd you know, done a first cull, and it must have been terribly difficult, but he didn't show it. It must have been terribly difficult to read of your life together and read what Barbara thought of him sometimes, where she got really angry with him, and those wonderful examples where she cut the crutch out of all his trousers. It must have been very hard to A, relive the life, and B, see what your partner was thinking about you that you might not have known. I said, well, you know, is there stuff here you want cut out, you know, of any personal nature? And he said no.
Saturday, 7th of January. This is a terrible day. Yesterday, Joe posted the typescript of Cupid Doll and a letter reporting on what I had done with my last year's fellowship. Telling of writing Cupid Doll was all right, but it also mentioned the research for the book provisionally titled Annie Magdalene, which was wrong. Because Joe read over all my work on that book this morning, and he does not think it publishable, I know. I don't know what to do. I wish I was dead. I hate being here. How will I get through the next days?
One thing that actually amused me in her diaries, where she's saying that it's so unfair that Peter Carey and David Maloof have been picked up by American publishers and she hasn't, and she knows she's a much better writer than David Maloof, not that she's read any of his books.
Because I love that, because it's so human. I mean, I think everybody can be like that. All artists have to have egos. I mean, if they don't have a big ego, they're not going to survive because it's tough. And they have to believe they're good. I've spent my whole life looking after artists, and that is nothing unusual about that. And remember, this was not for public. You know, she didn't know she was going to die. This was just getting rid of her angst when she got home.
The day after the diary's launch, the Adelaide Advertiser's banner headline screamed, "Diary from the Grave, the book that shocked Adelaide." There was a more moderate review that described the diary's launch at Adelaide Writers' Week. First, a hum under the trees that turned out to be the fevered fanning of pages as people looked themselves up. There was more than one white face and a bit of a rush to the bar. Kate Llewellyn.
When you write a diary, you may not be aware of it, but posterity is a very sly thing and it creeps up on you. But you can't go back and undo your old diaries, you see, that's what people don't understand. So what was said, truly not intending to have it published, it's too late. That's, you know, 10 years ago. You couldn't find it. You wouldn't be bothered. She's a writing, working artist, fighting for her life anyway. So posterity's taken over and she's done for because all the malice is there and she can't expunge it and she's not going to throw her diaries away because she knows they're important. So that's how it happened.
When Barbara became sick, Joe gave up his work to assist her, recognising that she would both want and need to be creative until the end of her life. Michael and Me and the Sun was written when she was bedridden, and the final prints, full of joy and hope, were made with Joe inventing ways of propping her up so she could draw, then rushing off to the studio to make the proof so that Barbara could begin the next stage of her work.
1990, Monday, 5th of October. Here I am. Just after 8:30, in my flash hospital room, dearest Joe's in attendance. He had to change me pants many times yesterday, violent reaction to too many lavatory medicines. Poor Joe's and the jobs he does so kindly and uncomplainingly. Lummy. Tuesday, 16th of October. I want to be back in a world of trees and flowers and feeling the garden dirt and the glittering sky and reading Virginia Woolf calmly, clearly and thinking about her. Not here in bed, lying on my back because the ankles and feet, pins and needles hurt too much to walk freely. Please, God. I may be my old working, walking self again and can work at my prints.
Those diaries show a truly magnificent dying. There's one scene where she collapses in the bathroom with sheer terror at the knowledge. And her dying was truly magnificent. Her courage was absolutely gargantuan, and Joe's devotion and tenderness to her was really quite saintly, and I respect them both enormously for that.
What was it like for you when she did die?
Well, it was sudden, because we didn't know she was right at the end, and we were all shocked because we didn't know, but that's the way Barbara and Joe wanted it. And it was the most wonderful, wonderful funeral, because she was buried in the old part of the West Terrace Cemetery with her grandmother. And there's a, right next to the grave is a peppercorn tree. And that's, I always associate with my childhood, peppercorns. There were lots of peppercorns in Adelaide, and Barbara would have sort of sat under the peppercorn trees and that particular smell and the sap. And we all stood there in the heat in this wonderful historic graveyard. Joe was just in his jeans and his check shirt that he always wears, and it was all normal. And Joe was comforting people. I felt it was emotional, but right. You just get this feeling, this is how it should be, if it has to be.
Type away slowly. Did 4 pages this morning, and I work at my etching. I began writing out my London past. Probably no good, but I shall keep at it, I think. So strange to remember the lovely grace of turning and lying at will in your body.
This week, I visited Joe in his house, which has become a tribute to Barbara. It is filled with her work, the small objects she loved, and photos. It is further embellished with wonderful rugs from the Middle East and silk wall hangings from India. They contribute perfectly to Barbara's aesthetic and somehow keep alive this wonderful woman. It's been a great pleasure to once again visit the life of Barbara Hanrahan with its vivid imagination, alarming memory, and extraordinary creativity. These qualities were hers, and in abundance. Liz Williams, sculptor and friend.
Barbara Hanrahan died of cancer on the 1st of December 1991. She was 51 years old. Some believed she and other printmakers of the time were killed by the toxic materials they worked with. During her lifetime, Barbara Hanrahan held around 22 solo exhibitions and published 15 novels and books of short stories. She completed that novel about her early years in London, called Michael and Me and the Sun. It was published by the University of Queensland Press after her death. And by the way, she did find that American publisher.
You've been listening to Hindsight. The Strangeness of the Ordinary, The Art and Life of Barbara Hanrahan, was produced by Nicole Steinke with technical production by Timothy Nicastri. Readings from Liz Williams' speech were by Robin Ravlich. Readings from The Scent of Eucalyptus and The Diaries of Barbara Hanrahan were by Lucia Mastrantoni. Thanks to Joe Steele and Beata Giuseppe and to Alison Carroll, the author of Barbara Hanrahan, Printmaker. To see some of Barbara's art, head to our website at abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. And while you're there, you can also listen to an interview recorded with her in the 1980s and a recent interview with a collection of weavers who've spent years working on the community-based Barbara Hanrahan Tapestry Project. The news is next here on ABC Radio National.